that's how we start the show. Eagle soar and oil flow. You didn't decide what you chose. We will pay back what they owe. Crime depends from who you sold. We cheer for the villains though. Hustling, bustling, getting low. Motion is perpetual. We call Jill to give and go. All you reap is what you sow. No, where are the controls? Mass of individuals consuming as ritual. You ain't hear them say ride slow. Dude, don't let them play us.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Istanbul is Ozgur Orangazi, who's an economist who has worked extensively on the financialization of the U.S. and world economies and the causes and results of financial crises. He is the author of Financialization and the U.S. Economy, and currently he's based in Istanbul at Kadir Has University, where he's undertaking further research on the financialization of the economies in developing countries. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ozgur Orangazi.
Hi, Ian.
So the financialization of the United States economy has really happened, I think, at a historically very rapid pace, has it not? It's up to about 40% of the total economy, or perhaps more at this point.
Correct, yes. When we're talking about the financialization of the U.S. economy, we see two things happening at the same time since probably early 1980s. On the one side, the volume of financial transactions have increased tremendously. And as you said, it's now about 400% of the total GDP of the U.S. And at the same time, the size and the profitability of the financial sector have increased immensely. When we look at the profits that are made in the economy, we see that more than half of them are actually being made by the financial institutions.
So what explains this? Is it inexorable, or what is driving it?
Well, it is actually quite a complicated issue. When we look at what's going on, we see the beginning of this financialization process essentially in the late 1970s. There are two things that are happening at the same time. 1970s is a period when the U.S. economy is going through a very significant crisis. And at the same time, there are all sorts of attempts to sort of like deal with this crisis. On the one hand, we see the beginning of a gradual deregulation process of the financial sector in the U.S., which actually opened the doors for all sorts of financial innovations in the coming years. And at the same time, on the production side, we see a significant shift in terms of production sites, where most of the production began moving to sort of like low-cost sites. And domestically, there is a significant what you could call an attack on labor to decrease essentially the cost of production in the U.S. and to sort of like make production profitable again.
Well, you didn't use the word outsourcing, but that's of course become a
right.
word now in the presidential campaign, I might add, in the
yep.
battle between President Obama and challenger Romney. It's very much the word of the moment. I mean, there's two things. There's globalization, financialization, and they obviously are working together. But let's talk about personalities here, because often personalities drive history, and you've made the point in your book, Ozgur Orangazi,
right.
The Financialization of the U.S. Economy, that there are many historical indicators of the decline of hegemonic powers. And obviously, we're talking now about the decline of the United States, the examples being Imperial Venice, Genoa, Holland, and Britain,
right.
all saw their power rise on the back of productive industrial capitalism, followed by the domination by the financial sector, which eventually began to cannibalize the productive sector in pursuit of financial returns and
right.
limitless profits. So that seems to be, I think, a fairly reasonable description of what's happening here in the United States. How much did, for example, Alan Greenspan drive this? Because you mentioned that things changed, what, about late 70s, 1980?
Right, right. Well, in fact, you're right to point out that there's significant parallels with what happened in the earlier era, so sort of like with the Genoese cycle, with the Dutch cycle, with the British cycle. What we saw in these cycles was essentially, the decline of hegemonic power of these empires were accompanied with a significant increase in the size of finance again. And there are actually a lot of scholars who sort of like point out to this this parallel and talk about what's going on right now. There's one significant difference, I guess, in this cycle, as the U.S., although in terms of the economic power, might be in decline, depending on what measure you actually look at. But in terms of military power, we can't actually talk about the same thing. That is, you don't see the similar sort of like rise of another military power like we saw in the other cycles. So when we actually fast forward and come to 1980s and 1990s, Alan Greenspan's major role in this process, I guess, has been his sort of like stance where he argued that the markets, and especially the financial markets, would be self-regulating, meaning that if there was excessive risks, the markets would correctly price them, the markets would correctly allocate resources to their best users, and his stance would be to basically do not do anything, which actually made it quite easy for the financial sector to sort of like grow in size in this sense. And this indeed seemed to be working for a long time for the U.S. economy. You know, when you look at the 1990s, when you look at the 2000s, you see the financial booms until 2007 when this whole thing started coming apart, actually.
Again, I'm speaking with Ozgur Orangazi, who is in Istanbul, Turkey. He's an economist who has worked extensively on the financialization of the U.S. and world economies and the causes and results of financial crises. He's the author of Financialization of the U.S. Economy, and currently he's based in Istanbul at Kadir Has University, where he's undertaking further research on the financialization of the economies in developing countries. So I'm wondering, though, since we have these two first of all, our understanding of American capitalism, I think, in many ways, is based upon the robber barons all the way through Henry Ford, Edison, all of the innovators. And the one thing that they appear to have in common is that they produce goods and services and, by extension, jobs. And in fact, Henry Ford, is even though he's a political reactionary, he believed that you had to pay your workers enough to buy the products that you made. It seems that as our economy becomes more and more financialized, the people at the top, if you will, the 1% on Wall Street, seem to be only interested in extracting wealth and not creating wealth. At least that's their priority, is to extract fees and bonuses for themselves. So how much is this idea that Wall Street provides the seed corn of capitalist innovation in America? How much is that a myth?
Well, in fact, when you look at the history of capitalism, you see that most of the significant innovations, most of the fundamental innovations, essentially don't come through the private sector, but they come through the public sector. That's the first observation we have to make. The second thing, when you look at the Wall Street, in fact, when you look at the funds that go in and out of the Wall Street, say, take the stock exchange, we see that after 1980s, the stock exchange in the U.S. economy has been a net receiver of funds rather than a net supplier of funds, which implies what you were actually talking about, that Wall Street has been extracting funds from the rest of the economy rather than providing funds to the rest of the economy. So this is an important point that we need to look at. One thing that I want to add to your description is that on the one side, yes, we do see financialization of the economy, but under this, we shouldn't forget that there are fundamental issues, fundamental contradictions about the productive side of the economy as well. When we're talking about a capitalist economic system, the most fundamental thing, I guess, is that production is done for profit. So if it's not profitable, nobody will produce anything, right? And second, production is done for sale. That is, if you cannot sell the products that you're producing, there is no point of production. So when you look at the underlying system, what you see is that the system actually had problems both with profitability and with the sale of the product. So in that sense, financialization actually, in a way, helped to the productive side to a certain extent.
But at this point, it seems that the financialization, and particularly the excesses that led to the 2008 crash that's done incredible damage to the economy and particularly to the consumer economy, and 70% of the U.S. economy is based on consumption, isn't the real problem that we have now lack of demand because people aren't buying products? And when you have a political campaign where one candidate is talking about being a job creator, that's a total myth because capitalists only hire workers when they have customers and demand for their products. They don't do it out of altruism. They hire workers because they need to hire them. They have to hire them to meet the demand from the consumers.
You're absolutely right. There's two ways to look at this. One is this argument that the financial crash actually led to this crisis and, you know, led to all these problems in terms of the demand. So the consumers cannot borrow now, the firms are not making investments, and hence we have a lack of demand. But there's another way of looking at this. When you look at two things since 1980s, one, the real average wage of an American worker that has been pretty much stagnating since late 1970s. Two, when you look at the income distribution, the distribution of income has been worsening every year, almost every year. So this actually has an implication for the lack of demand in the sense that those whose real incomes did not grow had to borrow in order to finance their consumption. So what happened with the crash of the financial system was that they now cannot borrow because they reached to the limits of the borrowing. So when you take that borrowing and all sorts of other financial sources of demand out of the system, you do see that on its own, the productive basis of the system was incapable of producing enough demand for the sustainability of the system. That's another way of looking at this situation. So in that sense, it becomes a question of how do you ensure that there's demand? Either do you do this by creating sort of like some sort of fictitious demand by credit or by actual jobs where people have incomes and they spend this money?
Well, arguably, Osgur Orangazi, that is what happened in the 1980s under President Reagan. Wages have been flat, as you pointed out, since the late 70s. And rather than maintain a standard of living for working Americans, credit was made incredibly easy, which gave the American workers and the middle class the illusion that their standard of living was being maintained. And this has led to the biggest bonanza for the financial system because the Fed loans out the money at, 2 or 3%, and then they can charge it back to the American middle-class, working-class people who have credit cards, et cetera, at, 18.5 or even more. So in providing the illusion that you're maintaining a higher standard of living through consumption, the banks made out like bandits.
What we're talking about here is essentially a fundamental contradiction of capitalism. It's manifested itself through a financial crash and an ongoing sort of like a financial crisis, essentially. But what we're talking about is a structural crisis of the system right now. That is, we like to see a dramatic set of events lasting for a number of years, maybe about a decade, and the collapse of the financial sector and the slowdown of the economic growth, the slowdown of the growth of the output is only one aspect of this. What we're talking about at the same time is issues of distribution. And as you correctly pointed out, if these issues of distribution are not sort of like in a way solved, creating jobs is essentially, or to talk about creation of jobs is essentially going to be a myth, as you correctly pointed out.
Well, isn't there a fundamental problem here, though? Again, Osgur Orangazi is an economist who has worked extensively on the financialization of the U.S. and world economies and causes and results of financial crises, and he's the author of Financialization of the U.S. Economy. The financialization of the U.S. economy has also been concurrently attended by the capture, if you will, of our politics by the most powerful lobbies. And clearly the most powerful lobbies in Washington, D.C. are the banking lobby, the military-industrial complex lobby, and I suppose also the insurance lobby. And do you think that that is, I mean, that's clearly a factor in the financial sector essentially being getting away with, I mean, a lot of what they do should be illegal. With the LIBOR scandal that we're now watching unravel from London, and it's going to come visit us pretty soon here, and some of the big U.S. Wall Street banks are clearly involved. That's an example of activities that should be illegal but aren't. And the reason that they're not illegal is largely because of the ability of the banking lobby to basically immunize themselves against criminal activity.
Right. In fact, a significant part of the financialization process was the increasing power of the of finance in general, or the financial sector in general. And you can actually see this in their lobbying activities. You can see this in terms of the deregulation process that took place in terms of the new laws and regulations that were put in place. And incidentally, after 2007, there was a lot of expectation that this these excesses of finance would be curbed, because there was like a popular sort of like discontent about the financial sector. That quickly passed away, and the few regulations that were brought in the U.S. were in the face of the size of the financial sector and all the stuff that they're doing, were quite weak, actually. And this is not an American phenomenon. In fact, when you look at the world economy after the 1980s, we see that country after country had experienced financial crises. And in each financial crisis, the priority was always to save the banks and the financial sector. In fact, in many cases, I've done some research on this, and in many cases, in Mexico, in Argentina, in Turkey, the first priority of the governments was always to save the financial sector, to transfer funds to the financial sector. And in some cases, there were a lot of legal changes made to enable this. In fact, there's one significant law that was passed after the 2000-2001 crisis in Turkey, which stated that those who carry out the bailout policies would be immune from any sort of like responsibility afterwards, because this was like most of the stuff that they were doing were not even in the books.
Well, we're witnessing that right now with Spain, right? The money's coming directly
exactly.
from the EU to the Spanish banks, and it's bypassing the Spanish government. That's
exactly.
That's how serious the situation is. But so, just in closing, then, Osgur Orangazi, it's very disturbing that that so much of this activity that we're talking about in terms of the financialization of the U.S. economy is so manifestly unfair and unproductive, not just in the economic sense, but in the social sense as well. For example, the average American through the last winter and spring was paying an exorbitant amount of money for gasoline. The price went up precipitously. It also did the same back in 2008 before the crash. It got up to $147 a barrel, oil did. Uh-huh. And 60 Minutes did an investigation, and they found that it wasn't the oil companies who were raising the price. It wasn't OPEC. It wasn't the Saudis. It was the big banks on Wall Street that own more oil than ExxonMobil could imagine.
Right. The oil, the speculation in oil is one example. You could also talk about the speculation in different types of food staples, right? You know, and what we've seen was a lot of instability in terms of food prices that has caused problems all over the world in terms of poverty and all that. What is clear to me is that the current sort of like setup is unsustainable. And what we're faced with this sort of like collapse of the finance, is not a simple crisis, not a simple business cycle recession, but more of a structural crisis, which is going to mean a longer period of economic stagnation and instability all over the world, and will not be resolved through the normal workings of the capitalist economy, which essentially means that the solution to this is going to be some sort of a political solution. And a political solution implies that it could go either way. It could actually get worse. It could get better. It could become more and more unfair. It could become a little bit more fair, depending on the political powers. In that sense, the Occupy Wall Street movement in the U.S. Raised a lot of hopes, even though now it's kind of like petered out in a way. But essentially, we're looking for a relatively long period of political struggles through which a new set of institutions are going to appear, in my opinion.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today from Istanbul, Ozgur Orangazi.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Ozgur Orangazi, who's an economist who's worked extensively on the financialization of the U.S. and world economies and the causes and results of financial crises. He's the author of Financialization and the U.S. Economy, and currently he's based in Istanbul at Kadir Has University, where he's undertaking further research on the financialization of the economies in developing countries. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about, go to Moscow and talk about how Vladimir Putin is furiously reversing democracy in Russia.